So we're doing the Inside Your Mind segment, and we originally used to say it was neuro-linguistic programming with Stephanie or something like that, and we had to keep explaining what those words meant, but we are looking at some neuro-linguistic programming today, aren't we?
So
let's explain what it means for those who people might have heard it. You've probably got your elevator speech ready.
Well, it seems to change all the time, but basically neuro is the mind and the body and the way we process information coming in from outside.
Yeah.
Linguistic is language, which is not just what we say or what we read, but anything that conveys a message. So it could be, you know, changes in skin tone. It could be pauses in how we breathe in. It could be, you know, some people get a rash on the neck sometimes when they're talking about certain things.
Yeah.
It could be hand movements, gestures, body language, all sorts of things. So anything that's conveying a message, and it's important to in that aspect of it to be able to pick up those messages, which can be quite subtle, you know. So also eye accessing, how we move our eyes when we're thinking about things.
Yeah.
And then the programming is how we are programmed to do the things that we do and think the way that we think. And that's from, that comes from parents, teachers, you know, social work. You know, we can continually be programmed and programming ourselves.
It's not people trying to program us, it's just we have programs in our brain that...
Well, sometimes people do program you, particularly your parents. They want you to behave in a certain way and do certain things so that, I mean, they probably wouldn't call it programming. They call it something else, you know, like parenting.
For instance.
Yeah, for instance. But it still ends up being a program. And sometimes those programs are very appropriate when we're three, but not when we're 33, you know. So then how do we change those programs so that they are more applicable to living as an adult in today's world than, you know, they were when you were three or whatever, whenever the program was kind of introduced. So even something like a trauma can create a program, or a phobia. You know, it's like usually people who've got a phobia, they've been they've seen something once or experienced something once, and then after that, the body just keeps reacting in the same way. That program was so strong that just one time ended up being a program that they continue to react to over and over again.
I guess, is it the case that if an experience is coupled with a strong emotional reaction, that it kind of embeds it in the brain better, more deeply,
Exactly. And same with traumas, with post-traumatic stress disorder, you know. It could be that the trauma has occurred over, sometimes it could be, you know, 20 years or more, but sometimes it could be just once and anywhere in between that.
Mm.
And neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP as we call it for short, has ways of dealing with that. So to separate, as you said, the emotion, separate the emotion from the memory so that you can remember it without experiencing the trauma again. Because the memories themselves can be useful for avoiding similar situations in the future.
Yes.
But you don't want to feel the feelings all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So that's a short version. Shortish version.
Shortish version. So today you want to talk about mental time and space, and for some reason that made my mind go blank when you said that before we went on the air. What do you mean mental time and space? What is that? Because that's in the context of neuro-linguistic programming, isn't it? Or the theories and ideas.
Yeah. Well, a bit more than theories and ideas, because it actually works. Theories and ideas are like theories and ideas, but this is stuff that, you know, has been proven to be work and is now being proven by science. So basically, we don't have anything. Well, let me go back a bit. So time is a construct in our mind to track changes. So there
is time is real though.
Well, is it? Because we've only got right now. Right this instant.
Okay.
And even what I said a minute ago, that's in the past now. We can't grab it and retrieve it apart from listening to it on the radio or a recording of it, right? And the same as in the future. We can talk about, oh, what's happening on Tuesday or what's happening on next week on Friday. But it's not something you can grasp or point to. It's just something in our mind.
Mm. Okay, so we make a mental construct of how time works.
And so we do that differently. We have a way of coding time in our mind. So for some people, they have, it's really interesting when you say to people, well, I'll ask on, just say on air and then see what people come up with. So if you could think about, if you were to think about the past, you know, and not consciously, but, you know, maybe unconsciously, if you were to think about the past, in which direction would you point to your past?
Yeah, I was like over my shoulder.
Over your shoulder, okay. And then if you think about the future, where would you point to for the future?
Yeah, and I'm about to point.
In front.
There in front, okay. In front, yeah.
And then where's now?
Here.
Right, and where would you point to for here then?
I guess I'd point at the ground.
At the ground.
Or down or...
Okay.
Yeah, something.
Right. Okay, so that's great. So then you've got a line that goes from behind you to in front of you.
Yeah.
So the past is behind, which kind of makes sense, and the future's in front and now is in front of you as well, but close. Right. So that's one way of coding time. Another way of coding time is the past is behind you, the future's in front, and now is in your body. So people, when you say, where's now, they actually touch themselves, so that you might touch themselves on the chest. So that's different from just in front and pointing down. And so those are the people that are always late for appointments who forget that they've got them.
Okay.
Because, right? Like, they're living in the moment. They're going, now is right here in my body.
Oh, yeah. Right. So if now is just in front of us, that implies we're kind of monitoring or...
I think that's a cross, because the other timeline is you ask people, you know, where's now, and they'll point left.
What?
Yeah. And you go, where's the future, and they'll point right.
Oh, because they're like reading.
Then they go, where's now, and they'll point to the same place you did, right in front, right?
Yeah.
So that timeline is called European timeline, and the one that you've got, kind of, is called Arab timeline. So the past behind and the future in front and now in the body is called Arab time, and it's traditionally hot countries where, you know, you don't rush around in a hot country because you get too hot, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, those countries, they can be having a meeting with somebody and then, you know, the time's going on and then they've got another meeting, but they're not aware that there's another meeting. So the other people arrive and they just join in with the first meeting and things like that, right?
Okay.
And it's the reason, that timeline is the reason that, you know, doctors and dentists and people always ring you up and say, oh, just remind you, you've got an appointment tomorrow or this afternoon or something. Mm-hmm. Because those people, you know, especially if it's more than about 3 weeks away, they struggle to kind of remember because they're living in the now.
Maybe that's what happened to my first interview this morning.
Is that right?
Yeah, there's a tune-up. Monday morning as well, of course. That's always, yeah.
Yeah,
they're supposed to be at 8:30. Okay, but the left-right thing, is that because that's from where they're used to reading? And
it's interesting because it seems to be, it may be that readings come about because of that timeline.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but...
Yeah.
They say it's from, they call it European time, and it's come from the Industrial Revolution. So before that, people used to just get up, work in the fields all day and go to bed when it got dark, presumably.
Yeah.
And then it was like they started having factories and people were having to make things. And so it was no use if people just turned up whenever they felt like it, you know. So it became this thing where, you know, well, we're going to start at 7 o'clock in the morning with this lump of iron ore and we're going to put it into this furnace and smelt it, and then it's going to be poured out into these moulds, and then the moulds are going to be, you know, pushed off the end of the production line, and then we're going to do this. And it became like a process, and it became outside of people. So for those people, time is outside of them.
Yeah.
Whereas the people that have got now, when they actually touch the body, not like you did, I think you got, which a lot of people have, a combination of the two. So, you know, like if you're running a radio station, right, it wouldn't be just appropriate if you just got up and think, oh, well, I'll go into work now, and then you got here and it was like 12:30.
Yeah, I'm really precise about, during these 2 hours, I'm really precise about what happens.
Right, right.
Yeah, much more than the rest of the time.
Right, I was going to say, and then the rest of the time it probably doesn't matter that much, you know, or at the weekend it's like, well, who cares, it's the weekend, you're just doing, you know, whatever you're doing. So, and so the thing is with the two timelines, well, there's more. Like I've had people that have got like a helix, and however people code time is fine. Oh, no. And I think I mentioned this before when I was at work in the power company, There was a guy that was – he was like a senior engineer. He'd have to go out on site and figure out what people needed when they were on like a new subdivision, right? So he was a senior guy. And it just – it was late for everything. You know, sometimes he just didn't turn up. He didn't turn up on site. People were complaining. And so I said to him one day, I said, you know, this is getting ridiculous, because he was on a warning, you know.
Right.
Because people were just turning up and he just didn't turn up. And he'd have his computer and he'd have two alarm clocks beside the computer. So he'd set the first alarm for the time that he needed to leave and he'd set the other one for like 5 minutes later in case he forgot. And he'd turn the first one off and just be so engrossed in what he was doing that – you know, he'd just go, he'd hit the top of it to turn it off and carry on doing what he was doing, not thinking even that the second one was going to go off. And then the second one would go off and he'd hit that and he'd still be engrossed in what he was doing, right? So the thing is about that timeline then is that those people with that timeline, they can work in a bomb site. You know, it doesn't matter. They're just like totally focused on what they're doing now, right? Whereas the people with the other timeline, left to right, mine's like that. You know, I can change it. But mine's like that. It's like I can't work if the place is a mess. If I'm in my office and the office is a mess, I can't work because it just distracts me every bit of mess. So it has to be tidy, right?
Yeah.
So these are the differences. These are one of the differences, right? So anyway, I said to him the one day, I said, I think, you know, can I help you with this? Can we do some work on this? And he goes, yeah. He said, okay. So I asked him, you know, if you were to think about your past, where would you point? And he points out in front and I was like,
right.
Wow, I haven't come across this before. You know, this is different. I think I just finished my practitioner training. And I said, and if you were to point to the future, where would you point? And he pointed behind him. I was like, okay, yeah, this is different, you know.
Blind to the future.
So, but now it was in his body, you know.
Yeah,
so everything
well
was happening in the now. But it was just back to front. And I'm going, this is just weird, you know. And anyway, I said to him, I said, well, you know, we can change it, you know, because you can change the timeline. So he was really reluctant. And I said, okay, well, you don't change things unless it's, we call it ecological, unless it's okay for the person. So I said to him, well, okay. He says, because it's been quite useful. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, for example, I got this job because of how I am now. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, every Friday night he used to go and get fish and chips for the family. And so he got fish and chips this one Friday night and opened up the chip paper and there was the job advertised in the chip paper, right? The newspaper.
What's that got to do with a sense of time?
Well, it was kind of like it was meant to be. So it was kind of like, and there was a few other things like that.
Where it doesn't sound like an engineer, does it?
No, it doesn't. I know. It was like, I was quite bemused by the whole thing, you know, and there was some other things. I can't remember what the other things were. I just remember that one about the fish and chip paper where it had been quite useful for him. The way he thought about things would be quite useful. I go, well, is it useful for you now? Because you're on a second warning, you know?
Yeah.
And anyway, we resolved these other things and then I had him change the timeline. I won't go into how you do that because, you know, you need to be with me or somebody that knows what they're doing to change it.
It's not a thing we do on mass over the radio.
No, exactly. So we changed it and then he was fine, you know. It was like he could still be in the now when he wanted to be, but he got it the other way around, and he could still set his alarm, but he'd actually respond to it on the computer, so he saved his job.
Are there cultures where they have their timeline like his?
Yeah, so it's kind of, I don't know about back to front, but back, you know, like yours, but with now inside, any hot country. Like my father's Jamaican, his timeline was like that. Mum was like mine. It's one of the...
Your mum was English?
Yeah, mum's English.
English,
and she... So the thing is with it is it's one of the greatest sources of arguments in a relationship.
I could see it. I talk about this quite a bit. I lived in the islands when I was a kid, between 12 and 14.
Yeah.
And my dad had a job over there, and him and all the other expat people from Australia, New Zealand, sometimes the US and England as well, they'd all get together and the discussions, there was kind of a racist overtone, but there was also genuine confusion about how things worked with the local population, and a lot of it was based around that, I think. Just in a completely different headspace.
Yeah.
How do we get them into our headspace, of course?
Yeah, and
because they'd been sent as the experts, right, to make things happen, so they wanted everyone to do the things the way they said they should be done, but it was...
Yeah.
In the end, you either developed a sense of humour or went crazy with it. That was kind of the, you know.
It is quite interesting. And I know for me, like, I can change my timeline. So, you know, when if I'm planning something, I want my timeline to go left to right, because let me just go back a step.
Yeah.
So people who have for the past behind and the future in front, the timeline for them goes all the way back to whenever, you know. But people who have the timeline left to right, it extends the length of your arms outstretched.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you've got a window into
so
your timeline.
So I can see all of it.
Oh.
Right. So that's the good thing. The downside is, you know, when I want to make a decision, I go, I think I did that before and didn't go that well, right? The people who have it the other way, they might make the same mistake more than once. So, but they might make the decisions easier because the past is behind them and they can't see it, you know?
Mm.
So the other option is that the timeline is – so the definition of the European timeline is – that you can see the whole timeline. So it might be in like a V shape.
Yeah.
It might be in a slightly wider V, so you can see it in your peripheral vision.
Yeah.
But if it's behind you, then it's the other timeline. And so, you know, the differences can be like, a bit like before I found out about it, so, you know, I'd be like, I had an appointment with somebody at, say, 10 o'clock. And at 10:03, I'll be walking up and down, looking at my watch, going, "Where are they? You know, what? Where are these people?"
Yeah.
And then I learnt about timeline. It's like, oh, okay. So I could tell almost from the first time what the timeline was by what time they arrived. that's useful to know. So neither of them are right or wrong; they're just different. But the difference can cause disruption in a relationship if you don't know, because, you know, like my mum always used to be saying to my dad, oh, you know, come on, get a move on, you need a hand grenade up your bum to get you moving, you know.
Yeah.
And my dad would just be cruising through like Jamaicans do.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing his own thing. He'd still get through everything, but in his own time, you know. Whereas mum, you know, even when she retired, she'd still get up really early to get all the housework done so she could sit outside on the sun lounge and read a book. Because she can't do it. She can't read the book until everything's clean and tidy.
Right.
Right. So, and so for somebody who's got an in-time timer, that doesn't even make any sense. You know, like the sun's shining, why don't you get out there and read your book and do the housework later?
Yeah.
You know.
So I think my way of coping with my timeline is to force myself to be more like that timeline where it's going crossways.
Yeah. And that's why I say it's a hybrid.
So it's kind of constantly whipping myself to be who I'm not as well, I think.
Yeah, and absolutely it makes sense because, you know, if you, in the society that we're in where we have meetings and we have things and things operate in time, people are forced to do something different to what their natural way is.
Yeah, oh, I remember in our primary school, when you were in a standard 3 or 4, you would have the responsibility of being the one who rang the bell at the end of lunchtime, I was always forgetting.
So everybody had an extra long lunch.
And I was such a well-behaved kid. It was really out of character.
Right.
But yeah, it was a constant problem for me. And the days that I had to do that, I kind of whipped myself into a person who's usually reasonably on time.
Yeah, and so that's typical of what that person is like. And then at the weekend, they're like, oh, thank God I can relax a bit now. I don't have to do things on time.
For me, it's the end of the day.
At the end of the day, yeah.
Yeah, when bedtime arrives, then I want to stay up because I'm relaxed. This is a weird... I'm being psychoanalyzed here.
No, you're not. No,
I'm doing it to myself. But there's a better way to do that. Obviously, you could teach someone how to lay their timeline out in front of them so they can see everything.
Well, the thing is, it's not that one's right and the other one's wrong. They're just different. But there's different characteristics. Like, as I said, you know, people with now, when now is inside, so they're back to front, you know, back is the past and the future is in front and now is in the body. So they actually physically touch the body when you ask them where's now.
Yeah.
Those people are really good at just focusing on something and getting it done. But they're not very good at planning. So that because they can't really think about the future very much, so they reckon about 3 weeks in the future is about the farthest that it's that they can plan.
Right.
So they need help to kind of strategize and get things done in the right way. So somebody with a different timeline can help them to do that. But the person that's got the timeline left to right, they're really good at planning stuff, but they might not actually enjoy getting stuff done as much because they're always focused on, well, you know, what time is it? Have I got time to do this now? Or being concerned about what happened in the past. So they're often not here now. So the person whose timeline says now is inside them, they are right here now, present. The person with left to right, they're often thinking about what happened yesterday or what they've got to do tomorrow. They're not present.
I'm very much in the future. Like if someone tells me some bad news about something, doesn't matter what it is, my brain will immediately go to the full extent of what that means for the future.
All right.
And sometimes people are like, don't you care about this bad news that's just happened? But my brain's going, what all the implications are till the end of that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And how far away in the future do you go?
Well, as far as that particular narrative goes, really.
Right.
So what the ultimate outcome is.
Right.
Yeah.
That I don't think that's about time now. That's more about the systemic approach to that particular instance and where it's going to go to.
I do that with everything, though.
Yeah. So it may also not relate to time. It might be, well, this will happen and this will happen and this will happen, and that could all happen in the space of 20 minutes. Or it could happen in the space of 4 years.
Yeah.
It's more about the consequences of that thing rather than the time involved in it.
Okay. Yeah, I see.
Yeah. So what are some other different characteristics? The language, people will say, I just want to put that aside now and move on. So they're putting it aside to the side, whereas somebody who has it behind them say, oh, I just want to put that behind me and move forward.
Yeah.
You can tell, and also you can tell by people's body language. So often if they're talking about the past, they might be pointing behind them or pointing to the left.
Yeah.
Again, so that's the language part of NLP.
The behind me, but when I said over my shoulder, I was thinking my right shoulder.
Right.
And when I think about putting something behind me, it's my right arm pushing it back.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
As well. I don't know if the side means anything. Just on right-handed.
Pushing it back. Yeah, pushing it back.
Yeah, they're pushing it back. Yeah,
pushing
it
back behind you rather than pushing it to the side. Looking ahead, looking towards the future. Well, towards the future could be either to the right or out in front. So that's another thing that tells you. People who have the timeline left to right, they have a difficult time isolating specific events. So, you know, if you said to me, could you remember your fifth birthday? I can't.
Right.
I can't remember my 20th birthday. I can remember. I've got a general view of birthdays. Right.
Oh, right. Just one big birthday memory.
If it was traumatic, I'm more likely to remember something than if it was, and if it's isolated, right? If it's even a regular thing. So it's called a gestalt. So you have this kind of all-encompassing memory of a particular topic rather than isolated incidences. Whereas people with the timeline going back to front, they can remember instances, particular instances.
I always used to amaze my friends by saying, oh, I remember that thing 2 years ago that we did this, and I had like a really clear memory of it. And they were like, how do you remember all that stuff?
Yeah.
I can't do that anymore.
Right.
But yeah, I could very clearly remember things and pretty good on when they happened.
Yeah, and I think probably the major source of conflict between the two is the time, that in terms of people who have the left to right timeline, they will take it as a personal affront if you agree to meet them at a certain time and you're late, they'll take that as a sign of disrespect.
Mm.
Because they don't know that the other person isn't disrespecting you at all. That's just the way that I think differently. Like, but you can imagine how that creates conflict, though, you know?
Like the only way they would be late is if they decided to be late.
That's right. And the other thing is, the people who have timeline left or right, they know what time it is, even if they haven't got a watch on. They'll be able to tell you within 5 minutes what time it is.
Ooh.
Right. Whereas the other people, they go, I don't know, let's see, 9:35?
9:33. Yeah, okay. Although we did agree to meet at 9, so you've got a bit of a
But somebody with the other timeline, they might be going, oh, it might be nearly 10 o'clock or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and often they wear a watch anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, now people have got phones anyway, so, you know, they've got an ability to tell the time that way. So, but that is the thing that causes the most. Until they understand that people who have a different timeline are not, like, deliberately to upset them, that's just how they are. And the other thing is, if people with the left to right timeline are late, they know they're late. They know whether on time or late without a watch or anything.
Yeah.
Right. So that can be a major cause of stress between people who are in a relationship that have different timelines. But, you know, you can use it to your advantage. So the person that has the left to right timeline, if they've got a goal to achieve, you know, and the goal is like a year in the future, the person with the back to front timeline, they'll have lost it by after 3 weeks, because they'll be like, well, oh yeah, that's right, we're doing that goal. It's hard for them to keep it at the front of their mind.
Yeah.
Whereas the other person can, so they can help going, okay, well, you know, we're 3 weeks into it now. Let's set short-term goals of, you know, 3 weeks, and let's get that one done, and then let's do another one. So they can help each other.
Yeah.
Once they recognise that each has got strengths, and, you know, I mean, I don't even think that the other things are weaknesses. They're just different.
Well, it's diversity, and it's really important.
Exactly.
We know everywhere we look that diversity is beneficial.
Yeah.
So long as we're not all busily judging each other and scapegoating each other.
Because, if we haven't got blinders on, we can't see.
We're either we think they're too late, the other person thinks they're too obsessed with time.
Yeah.
With being time. Yeah.
You know, oh, you're too laid back. You know, oh, well, you're too pedantic and, you know, tight and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Why don't you chill out?
Yeah. Exactly. So the two, and being able to. You know, respect and also embrace the differences. That's the key. And that's, you know, often when I'm seeing couples, that can be one of the major stressors. And once they realise that the person's not doing it either way to upset the other one.
Yeah, from my perspective as someone who's not that detail-oriented, having someone to take care of the details is invaluable.
Right.
I wish I had someone like that in this job.
Yeah.
But I have to do all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to do. I find, and that's why I find, there's an experience I used to have in jobs where I had bosses where I'm a big picture thinker, but I'd be forced into the details.
Right.
And then I'd lose my big picture and feel completely at sea.
Right.
Quite lost.
Yeah.
Because of that. Yeah.
Well, the big picture and the details is a different thing again.
Okay. But that's similar to that. Like, I can see what I'm associating. Detailed thinking with the person who knows what time it is all the time, and big picture thinking with the person who's looking to the future.
Because you're
a big picture thinker.
Yeah, exactly. I don't do detail very well either. So the detail, and that's called specific and global.
You're weird, Stephanie.
No.
Can you be how can you know what the time is and not be detail oriented?
You know, if I'm writing a newsletter, I have to get my computer to read it back to me because I can't even see my mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, but I can hear them if I've written something and then I can change it. But the detail and it's called specific and global. So some people are very global in their outlook, and you know they can't handle people telling them. You know, they're saying, "Oh, what did you do? Did you have a good weekend?" And they go, the detail person, "I go, yeah." And they go, "Oh, what did you do?" And the global person expecting them to just say, "Oh, I went for a surf."
But you get the whole every detail.
Yeah, I got up at 7 o'clock, and then you go, oh my god, kill me now, right?
One of my kids is like that, and I'm always like, just give me the headline first, please. I need a headline because I can't remember all the details.
Yeah, it's right, because that's the thing is they don't give you I call it like the coat hanger to hang all the details on. You know, they just give you one detail after another, and if you interrupt them or they get interrupted, they go back to the start or back to where they left off, right?
Yeah.
So, and again, that's another thing that causes conflict in relationships, one person being really, really detailed and the other one being global, and in relationships at work where, you know, often the boss is global because that's what they're paid to do. And he might have a PA or something who's very detailed because that's what she's paid or he's paid to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like never the twain shall meet because the detailed person wants details to be able to do the job. And so they think that, you know, they need to give details to the boss because that's what they're paid to do. And then they get really upset when the boss goes into a trance.
Yeah.
After the second sentence.
He doesn't listen.
He doesn't listen and he's like, oh, my God, I'm not going to cope with it. And they go, you know, I have to teach them to give an executive summary and teach them the differences and that the person needs to ask if they need more details, ask specific questions to get the details they need to do the job.
Yeah.
Because, again, and there is a group of people that sit in the middle that have the ability to do both. But, you know, often in those kind of relationships and in marriages as well, you know, the differences can cause conflict because people don't understand. It's like, why do they keep giving me all these details? Why is he so vague about everything, you know? So that hasn't really got anything to do with mental space and time. So we talked about time. Shall we go into space?
Oh, okay, yes. So folks, we're talking to Stephanie Phelps. This is our Inside Your Mind segment. We're talking about neuro-linguistic programming today, which is something that Stephanie has learned and also teaches. And I wrote down on the piece of paper, mental time and space. So we just talked about mental time, where we imagine time is or visualize time. I don't know, it's weird. But it made sense to me when you said, where's the past? I'm like, behind me.
Yeah.
That all made sense, and the future's in front, and the now's right kind of here in front of me. But what's mental space?
So mental space is how we think about things and how we locate them in our mind in like a spatial way.
Yeah.
So the easiest way to think about it is with people, how we think about people.
Yeah.
And so one of the NLP trainers from Holland, Lucas Dirks, he came up with this idea of social panorama, so how we think about people in space. So, you know, again, if I say to people, you know, when you think about your partner, where in the space around you do you locate your partner?
Yeah.
So often they'll go, well, right in front. You know, and you go, okay, how far away? And they go, well, maybe, you know, a meter and a half. Okay, and what about your siblings? Where do you locate them? And where do you locate your children? So, you know, and then so they'll have them in kind of a hierarchy as well. So some people will be higher than others. Some people will be lower. So often small children will be lower, which makes sense because, you know, they'll be influenced by the parent. They might have, if they've been bullied, they might have the bully straight in front of them, about 6 inches from the face or 20 centimetres, whatever that is. And slightly above them. So literally in their face.
Yeah.
Right. And so again, the language tells us what people do. So they'll say, oh, I like to keep people at arm's length, or me and my sister are really close, even though the person might live on the other side of the world. In their mind, they have them close.
Yeah.
Or they might say, oh, somebody's behind me. And you go, okay, unless you, because they've got my back.
Oh, okay.
But other people might have them behind them because, you know, they're worried about being stabbed in the back.
Right, yeah.
So it's really interesting how we think about that, you know. But then that's about people. You know, we talk about distant relatives, close relatives. Mm. So that tells us, again, where we're placing those people. Like they might be far off on the horizon and spread out somewhere, you know, and close relatives are going to be closer. You know, we talk about close friends. And then we've got acquaintances. The acquaintances are likely to be a bit further away than the close friends. It makes sense because of the language that we're using, right? So that's a bit about social panorama. And it's useful in terms of how we might be relating to somebody or not relating to somebody. If we put somebody, I remember a guy I saw who he had a son who was about 10, I think, at the time, and he felt very kind of alone with his son. And I said, well, you know, have you got relatives or people? And he goes, oh, yeah, well, you know, they're not very close, though. And I went, oh, that's interesting, they're not very close. So when I asked him about social panorama, his son was, you know, like about a metre or two away from him. But when he thought about the relatives, they were all like 20 metres away. And anybody to do with him or his child was miles away. And I said, well, what happens if you bring them closer, you know, bring them into, say, 2 metres away? And he was like, oh, and he said, oh, he was kind of relaxed. And he said, oh, it feels really like a lot warmer. And I said, have you been in contact with those people? And he says, no, because they seem really distant. Right? But it wasn't necessarily that they were distant, but he'd made them distant, and then we respond as if they're distant.
See, if I'd been talking to him, I would have been, oh, you silly beggar. They're just, it's you, you're not calling them. Why aren't you calling? You should just call them.
That's right.
But you've kind of located an underlying
That's right.
system there that's, yeah.
So when he brings them closer, then it's like he feels that he could contact him, which he did, and then that made all the difference, and then all of a sudden he built the relationship back up again. But over time, he probably moved them further away in his mind. I don't know why. I can't remember. It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it's just an instance. And so, you know, what happens then as well is that we behave towards those people in the way that we think about them. So if we have somebody that we perceive as higher than us in our social panorama, then, you know, we can either look up to those people, we can put them on a pedestal, right?
Yeah.
So this is all the language that people use. Oh, yeah, I'll look up to them. Higher up in the organisation, you know, in England or in the UK particularly, there's this kind of class structure, so people are higher up or lower down, right? Mm. And then, you know, if you perceive somebody as being lower than you, then you'll talk about, you know, you might look down on them. Or they're beneath you. Oh, that's beneath me, you know.
Yeah.
So, again, the language that people use is an indication of what they're doing in the head in terms of their mental space, where they're locating people in their mental space. And then what else do people do?
I guess you've given an example of what use you've made of that, like just mentally.
Yeah, well, it's really useful for them because they're often not aware of how they're placing people as well.
Yeah.
And so when they change the way that I think about people, the relationship changes. So just imagine that in your social panorama you have somebody that's beneath you, right? So how are you going to behave with them? You're going to treat them like they're proverbial, you know?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so they then are going to respond according to how you're treating them. Well, if you change it and have them on the same level as you, then that's going to change probably your tone of voice, the language that you use, everything. They'll respond differently. So, and then this goes back to this kind of systems approach to things where, you know, like you and I are in a system. Well, we're in a system with the audience as well. Whatever I do affects you and affects, you know, the audience. And so if you change one thing, and it can be as simple as changing how you perceive somebody in your social panorama, then it's going to change how you relate to that person, and then that changes how they relate to you.
Yeah, and if you're not aware that you've done that, you'll be like, oh, they've changed.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was you that changed.
It was you that changed. And yeah. People often say that. I'll see people and they come back and go, I can't believe it. Everybody around me's changed. And I go, amazing, you come here and everybody else changes, you know. Because it's very subtle. It seems like it's nothing. And yet it's everything. And the same thing is if they're feeling beneath people.
Mm.
Because everybody's, you know, like I'm pointing up here above my head, everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
If everybody's up there, then they're going to feel small and insignificant. And so people will treat them like that. And then that confirms to them that they're small and insignificant. But if they just bring everybody down to the same level, what people, I'll tell you, I think I've mentioned this before. This woman years ago, she was actually a counsellor. And she came to see me because she'd been co-opted onto this high-profile, now what was it? It was some kind of group at Auckland University to do something. I can't remember what it was. But she said, I don't know what I'm doing there, Steph. And I said, what do you mean? She says, well, they've all got, you know, a PhD or they're working towards PhD. She says, I haven't got any of that. She says, you know. And as she was talking, she was looking up like they were all there in the room with her up high, you see.
Yeah.
And I said to her, I said, can I get you to do something? And she goes, yeah. So I said, I just want you to close your eyes. And she said, yeah. I said, now I want you to picture where those people are. So her head tilted right back. And there was about, I don't know, 8 other people on this committee that she had been co-opted onto. And I said, okay, so what I want you to do is I want you to move them all down so they're all on the same level as you. And so her head tilted down to normal height, and then she just went, like, what a relief.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then and that's all we did, you know, because now they're on the same level as her. So because often we've been taught to look up to people in authority, people with, you know, certain qualifications, etc.
That really changes how we behave in that situation.
It doesn't. Exactly.
You feel like you either become submissive and don't do anything, or sometimes I guess people feel like they have to fight for their position.
Yeah.
And fight to
get. Or overwhelmed by, you know.
Yeah, or they have to fight to be heard. And then the other people are like, why is this person so aggressive?
Yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah, that's a really good point. And so that was it. That's all we did. And she goes, I can't believe that. And it was like, yeah. Because that's how she'd been brought up. You know, you're brought up to look up to people, respect them, put them on a pedestal, all this language.
Yeah.
And just moving them down so they're on the same level. I always say, look, everybody goes to the toilet, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty basic at sometimes. But it's like makes people laugh and it's like, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
So then they're on the same level as you, and then you relate to them like they're on the same level as you rather than beneath you or above you.
Yeah.
And then the other thing with mental space is about that we locate everything in space. you know, if you think about home, where's home?
Well, I know where it is geographically.
Yeah, but in your mind, you've got it up and okay.
Yeah, I'm pointing exactly where it is, I think.
Over there, right.
Yeah, and on a slight tilt because we lower down.
Right.
Yeah. But that's geographical. Well, I find that easy.
But what about if you're in another country? Where would you point then?
I would have a go. I would have a good go at pointing to where I think New Zealand is.
Right.
If I'm in the UK, what's the other side of the world? I don't know. If I'm in Australia, I'd point eastward.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if you were to just think about, let's get you to think about something else.
Yeah.
What about your front door?
Well, that's the same. That's on the
house.
He's
closing his eyes now, so I can't see what he's doing.
I know where things are geographically, like quite easily. Right. Like I don't get lost when I'm driving around and things like that. So,
So in your house, then you've got like a geographic layout of your house as well.
But
you aren't in your house. You're here.
Yeah, so the house is over there, so I'm just pointing at the house again for when you ask where the front door is.
Right,
yeah.
And so you know where the kitchen and everything is.
Yeah.
Right, and the bedrooms and the bathroom and all that kind of thing. But you're not there, you're here in the studio.
Yeah.
So you must have it in your mental space.
Yeah, I did, because when you were saying the names of the rooms, I was mentally thinking where they all are. Right. And there was kind of a plan of it just in my head, just over there. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So Aaron's gesturing with his right hand.
Oh, yeah. The same direction I pointed to where the house is, I'm pointing to where the plan of the house is too.
Right.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying then is that while you're pointing over there, it's in your head. You've got a mental space map of it in your head.
Yeah.
And so, you know, by watching generally people's eye movements when they're thinking about different things, you can tell, you know, whether it's a visual image that they've got or whether it's, you know, a feeling that they've got about that or whether it's sounds.
What were my eyes doing then to start with?
Well, first of all, you looked in that direction.
Yeah.
And then when I asked you about the front door, you decided you were going to shut your eyes so I couldn't see. Or you couldn't see.
There you go, thanks. If you don't want Stephanie to know what you're thinking, close your eyes. Everyone will be, you'll be like, why is everyone closing their eyes around me now? I was thinking, when I closed my eyes, I was thinking about how I should think about it.
Right.
If you see what I mean? Like I was trying to work out a strategy for doing that. I think that's what was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a sign of my brain closing down for a moment. The eyes closed.
And then we've got location of people and we've got location of things and so everything is I say that people who struggle with food, that when they think about food, the food is all within arm's length.
Okay.
So it's easy to grab and take. And people who don't, it's further away. So they have things that they wouldn't eat, like maybe cakes and biscuits and chocolate, further away, and things that are healthy closer.
You can do that, or you can think about the chocolate being behind a locked door if you're really struggling.
Yeah, with 15 locks on it or something, you know.
Yeah.
So so it's this is about mental space then. So how are we thinking about things mentally in space, in our mind, you know?
Conceptual things like, I don't know, honour. Is that a thing that gets put on a... trust me to come up with a...
Well, honour is a value.
Yeah, so it's a value. So do values get located like that?
I think... No, I don't think they do, because they're just... They're things that you can't grasp.
Yeah.
You know, so if I say, oh, he's an apple and I've got an apple in my hand, you can see the apple and you can feel the weight of it and everything. But if I say, oh, he's love, you know,
he's like,
there's nothing there, right?
Yeah.
But it's like, what does love represent? So we have representations of love, which might be, you know, holding hands, kissing, hugging somebody. Those are all kinesthetic ones, but there could also be then a visual thing, like seeing the person's face.
Yeah.
So those are more... So the representation of the person that they associate with love, or persons, because it could be children and other people as well, anybody.
Family, yeah.
Yeah. So then that comes back to probably social panorama, and how do you represent love in terms of those people, you know?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but the honour and love and, you know, all those things are values. You can't hold them in your hand.
Yeah.
So that's why there's often arguments about them, you know, because... What love means to me might mean something completely different to somebody else. You know, we talked about this before with flexibility. What does flexibility mean? For me, it means doing what I want to do when I want to do it, you know, but that's no good if I'm working for somebody else.
Well, I said, when you said love, the thing that I thought of first was family.
Yeah.
And then I thought, there's a lot of people who are conservative who talk about family values and things like that, and those of us who aren't conservative don't really know what they mean. Like, why is family important?
Yeah.
As the center of your value systems, and it's a more like, I think, like it's a placeholder for something else.
Yeah.
It's like for hierarchy and authority and stuff like that.
Well, when they talk about family values, there's probably going to be a whole lot of values involved in family value, so it could be.
And family isn't a value itself.
No, I don't think it is.
It's
no.
it's a heading for a bunch of values.
Yeah, so it could be under family values. It could be respect, love, consideration, sharing. Off the top of my head, those are probably the values that would come under family values in my estimation, anyway.
Yeah.
But family values really means nothing unless you can specify what they mean. But probably people say family values thinking that everybody knows what they mean, but of course, you know, they don't, because it could be different for each family. For some families, it could mean, you know, doing what you're told when you're told to do it.
Yeah, which is kind of what I think that's the group of values that it goes with. When people talk about family values,
all right,
capital letters, underline, you know, like there's family organisations, they're usually kind of right-wing or conservative or something like that.
Right, and so that's what I mean, you see. So that
or
might
religious,
mean that
religious
for them
as well, yeah.
But it might not mean that, or it might mean that family values has come to have a different meaning to what they mean, or...
Yeah, well, so for people who don't share those value systems, when they hear the phrase family values, they have quite a negative reaction to it, because it contravenes their value system. And then the people who do like family values are like, what on earth is wrong with you? How can you not like and value families?
So it's kind of...
They're not talking about it properly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how we got into values.
It comes back to the language again, you see. So there's... there is some meaning that you attach to family values, which isn't actually very positive.
Well, I'm saying the people who have different values to conservative religious values,
right?
Well, because it's not their values, they'll react against it. So then the people who like family values will think that those people don't like families, or, you know, they're like, they don't understand. How can you, you know, they don't respect families. In fact, that's what you hear a lot from conservative religious people, like, the problems with the breakdown of the family and the people on the left and the rainbow communities breaking up families.
Right.
Like, I'm paraphrasing everybody here.
Right.
but trying to get to that thing, like the confusion, like you say, caused by. Yeah.
And I think the thing is as well with values is that, you know, we have, you know, probably some values in New Zealand that other people don't have in other countries. So, you know, we value life, whereas in other cultures, you know, life is meaningless in terms of the bigger picture. You know, like we couldn't conceive of strapping a bomb to ourselves and blowing ourselves up because we value life. But in other countries, they're valuing something beyond life, so that we struggle to understand. You know. So anyway, that's values. We've kind of gone off the topic.
I know, completely off the topic. I think about values a lot at the moment because it explains so much of the arguments and disagreements that go on.
And so the thing is with values is we talk about a particular value, like that one I gave you about flexibility, as if we know what it means. But it actually means different things to different people. You know, there was a... after the war, they invented this language called, what's it called?
Esperanto.
Again? Esperanto.
Yeah.
Because I thought, well, if we all speak the same language, then, you know, there won't be any disagreements. And so they had a, you know, a word for cup or mug and, you know, a word for pen and all the chair and everything.
It was a combination of European languages, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then they thought, right, okay, now we get into things like trust and love. Well, you know, a cup and a phone and you can hold in your hand, but you can't hold love or trust or anything like that in your hand. So then they had to decide what it means. And so you can imagine, you know, the English and the Italians and the French arguing about what love means, you know.
Put the Germans in there too.
And the Germans, yeah. And you put them all in there and they just ended up having arguments and leaving because they couldn't agree on what these things meant.
Yeah.
Because all of these things are embedded in the culture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you're trying to meld all the cultures together and come up with a new thing, it doesn't work because it's embedded in the culture. You go, no, that doesn't, you know, no matter how much you talk about it, that is not what love means.
Right? Yeah.
This is what it means. And they go, no, it doesn't mean that, right?
And that's why a lot of colonization involved suppressing languages as well.
Yeah,
for the same purpose. Right. Yeah. Hey, we've reached 10 o'clock, Steph.
Wow.
Time for us to go.
Time flies.
You knew it was close to 10 o'clock anyway, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And I've got a little clock right there that I can keep an eye on.
You've got one up there too.
Yeah. I mean, I say I'm really pedantic about time while I'm doing my show. I'm surrounded by clocks, so it's not hard to be, folks, we've been talking to Stephanie Philp about neuro-linguistic programming and the area of that, about mental time and space, how we visualize stuff and what the clues that gives us about why we might be screwing things up, I guess, is one way of putting it, isn't it?
Or doing things really well.
Yeah, or doing things really well, or having arguments.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah, so thanks for coming in. Steph, have you written about this at all on your blog or anything?
Yeah, if you go to Inside Your Mind and just go to free articles and then maybe just search for time or space or social panorama, there'll be stuff comes up.
Yeah.
Yeah, on that, yeah.
Okay, cool. Thanks for coming in.
Okay.
All right, folks, time to go for the day. I'll be back again tomorrow morning.